It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 370 of the More Than Just Go podcast. My name is Tim Mitra. I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined by Summer Panage in Brooklyn, New York today.
So, hey, nice to see you, Tim. Good to be here. How are you doing?
Nice to meet you, finally. Been following your Twitter posts and seeing you hanging from the ceiling of your apartment on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Without a net, I think, right?
Yeah, for that kind of work, we use mats. Like, I do sometimes use a mat, but you can't have a net because it interferes with the apparatus. So that was my old apartment. I don't have that in my new apartment.
So just for the people who are listening to the audio version of this is, we're talking about, it's, what do you call it? Aerial
rope. Yeah. Or aerial acrobatics. Yeah.
Cool. And so you've been doing that for a while, I take it, right? I kind of saw that.
Gosh, let me think. I think 18 years now. Yeah. 18, 19 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did you get started in that?
Let's see. Good question. So as a kid, I did gymnastics and martial arts, and then I got into rock climbing in my teens, and that is where I first saw someone doing aerial work in a rock climbing gym because the ceilings are really high. And I immediately was like, oh my God, it combines art and athletics, like teach me everything. And that's where it started, is I just started taking lessons with this one woman at my college, and it just became almost an obsession and kind of took over my life a little bit.
So I think I've seen Cirque du Soleil acrobats mm-hmm. do that. I've probably seen it. Things that I think like the circus kind of stuff, I've seen people do aerial work as well. Like, what kind of field of exercise is that, I guess, or dance is that?
It's kind of its own thing. Like, as far as dance goes, I've studied lots of kinds of dance over the years, just to kind of help influence how I move in the air. But like the art form itself is kind of completely unique. I train at like a little aerial studio, and you take classes in like conditioning and choreography and stretching and all these different things. And then you can use it for things like Cirque du Soleil. There's a lot of work in nightclubs. There's all kinds of different like places to perform. Cabarets, all kinds of stuff.
Cool. Yeah. Well, it looks interesting. And of course, I'm allergic to pain, so I will never never try that.
It's a little painful.
Yeah. Well, it could be, I guess, right? It must take a while to you must fall occasionally, like, or.
Yeah. I mean, you definitely fall a fair bit. No question there. I think you learn to fall safely, and you learn to train really low to the ground for new movements. So the falls are very small. The bigger injuries really come from, burns and, like the wrapping of the rope around the body can move organs and bones around. So that can be problematic. Okay. Yeah.
So is it like since we're on it, is it like a regular rope, or is there like a specialized kind of rope for that?
It's a special kind of covered rope. So you can use different kinds, but the kind that most artists use is usually a cotton core braided rope, and then it's got this like cover on it that gives it just the right texture to make it grippy, but not so grippy it like pulls your skin off.
Okay, yeah. I guess that would be a problem. You don't want that to happen. Cool. All right, cool. And so, I think you've been working, we're obviously interested in iOS on this show, so you've been working as an iOS engineer for a number of years, I take it, right? And I think you're a manager of this role, in this current role, right?
Yes. So I'm technically an EM, but I still code a lot because it's a bit of, I can explain more later, but it's essentially, it's a very interesting role that I have at Slack. But yeah, I started iOS development in, 2010. Yeah, 2010.
And before that, you studied at Stanford, I think, right? And
yes.
So did you do a whole computer science route or...
No, well, yes and no, I guess. My master's was computer science, but my bachelor's was psychology. And so I didn't start programming until my senior year of my bachelor's. So definitely a late bloomer in that respect.
Okay. All right. So do you come at that from like the whole, you know, liberal arts and engineering together, kind of, that's sort of one of Apple's credos. But is that something that you kind of would lean towards? Like, I know you're a musician, for example, mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah, I don't think I had a plan, truthfully. It's you know, I wish I could be like, yes, I had this grand plan of doing the, you know, little psychology, little computers. I had a lot of really varied interests and I wasn't quite sure where I would end up. And I thought I wanted to go into psychological research. And then as I started to finish that degree, I was like, it's just not quite the right fit. I need something more engineering-y. And, someone just kind of suggested I try a computer science class because they knew I was, you know, I like to make little websites and, you know, just odds and ends. And I took one and was like, oh, this is it. This is what I want to do now. Yeah. And so it kind of just ended up kind of blending together then eventually into accessibility work.
Cool. And so we'll come back to accessibility in a minute. But so as a kid, were you like a computer science or sorry, a science math kid or an art kid or just everything, an athlete, I guess, too?
Mostly I would say I was mostly like a science math kid, and tinkerer and play on the computer and make little, programs on my TI calculator, that kind of kid. But I also was a musician. I started playing the flute at eight or 10, pretty young. And so music was a huge part of my childhood. And then I didn't play team sports, but I was a martial arts kid too. And so I had my, you know, karate classes every day after school. And so kind of a mix, a whole bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm. I tried flute for a while too. And so why flute? Why were you drawn to it or?
Well, growing up, I grew up and I went to Catholic school and, the church choir had three instruments in it. It had a piano, a flute, and a guitar. So those are the only instruments I knew existed because I'd never seen an orchestra at that point. And of those three, I really liked the flute. If I could go back in time, I would pick the cello.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. 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 Yeah, I always wanted to play guitar. I mean, I play guitar now, but I always wanted to play guitar as a kid, and mm-hmm. It just wasn't in the cards for me until I got my own money in university, and then I could, you know, spend some of my student loan on a guitar. But
yes,
yeah. So I tried flute for a while, but I was horrible at practicing, and I think the teacher got really frustrated with me. But anyway, yeah. So as a kid, you mentioned you were working on a computer. Like, what was your sort of early experience with computers?
I think it's, you know, started off like a lot of kids in my generation, you know, like just basic stuff playing around on in, you know, Encarta and, you know, just like learning to use a computer. And then eventually I started tinkering with, like making HTML, just little tiny websites or, you know, I had GeoCities and you could like customize the themes and things like that. Just like little tiny, like kind of tinkerings. And I didn't even know you know, no one in my home was an engineer. No one had even actually gone to college. And so, like, I didn't know that type of tinkering was, like, a job someday. And so it was just, like, fun and games to me. I was just playing on the computer. And that was really all I ever did was just, like, make some websites. I think I taught myself some JavaScript. I got into some of the earlier computer games, like King's Quest and Hugo's House of Horrors and those kind of, like, adventure games and, you know, text-based sort of things. And those were kind of my early days with computers. Like, I really enjoyed them, but they were more of a toy to me than anything. Like, I didn't know that they could be more.
Right. And so were you a gamer at all? Like, or just computering? Like, in school and stuff, or at home, or...?
I wasn't allowed to have like a console or anything. So I never would say I was a gamer. Like I did eventually, I think when I was in my like later teens, get a Game Boy. And that was very fun for me. But even then I didn't play it that much. So I would say like, I'm still to this day, like a very lightweight gamer. Like I have a Switch, I play some things, but I'm not deeply in the world.
Right. Right. Well, I think like, you know, I think if you've got physical activities that you do, you tend to be have less time for other things, I guess, right? Because I mean, you have to be practicing and stuff like that, right?
I think that was part of it. Yeah, just so much practice.
Yeah, cool. So on the accessibility side, you mentioned, how did you get involved in that? I mean, like, I know you worked as an accessibility manager at Apple. I assume you were on the team doing some of that stuff, and now you're doing it at Slack as well.
Yeah, so it all started really quickly. So my very first job out of grad school was Apple, and I was not on the accessibility team, but I was on the UI automation team. And that framework is based on top of accessibility. And I found myself much more excited about the accessibility parts than like my own job, which was the UI automation parts. And luckily my manager at the time kind of noticed that and ended up embedding me into the Maps team to help with the accessibility of what would become Apple Maps. This was before it had shipped. And so that's when I met the people, one of the people who I ended up working with then in the future. And that's also how I got exposed to accessibility, just like as a concept, and like started to learn the APIs and got really excited about it. And so I spent maybe a year working on the Maps product. And then at that point I chose to leave Apple just because I wanted to spend more time doing circus, truthfully, doing the aerial stuff. And so that was really the only reason I left at that time. But at that point, I'd been doing, you know, kind of some accessibility for a year. And then I kind of went to Twitter after that and found myself just like really excited about working on accessibility there. It wasn't hired for it, but it just was what excited me when I saw the bugs I could choose from.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's an interesting thing because, I mean, my mother and my sister are occupational therapists, so accessibility, in a sense, has always been, you know, getting through life, getting through the day, putting on your clothes, making your food, you know, all those kind of things that Apple and iPads don't touch, necessarily, yeah. Or maybe they do, I don't know, but, you know, for a lot of iOS engineers, accessibility is like we kind of draw the line at voice over. I'm being just generally, that's what I find. And, you know, or we might be setting up something for QA with, you know, by using accessibility identifiers as handles for that kind of stuff. But, you know, as someone who's obviously passionate about accessibility, can you sort of tell the rest of us who, I mean, I know a lot about it, but I mean, can you tell my audience, as it were, why it's so important?
Yeah, I think it kind of goes back to, I think that you hear Apple say this a lot, but like accessibility is, it's a human right. And like, I fundamentally believe that as well. And so in order for, you know, to me, like technology is something that everyone can purchase, and that means everyone should be able to use it. And so accessibility needs to be part of it. And there are, you know, there's many different ways that people can use a device, and those ways can vary in how, you know, through all the different senses, through all the different abilities, through vision, through hearing, through cognition, through learning, through motor abilities. And all of those are a complete spectrum. And I think that accessibility means trying to meet people where they are, so that they can enjoy a device and a product or an application just as much as someone who's in a different place and is going to enjoy it in a different way.
Mm-hmm. So how would you approach like teaching developers about accessibility, like, you know, beyond, like I said, let's just make our table view work with VoiceOver. Like, I mean, I know that dark mode is an accessibility mode, and that dynamic type is another accessibility feature. And I actually now, and have for the last few years, been using larger type because, as you can see, I've got my accessibility device on my head.
Exactly.
As I get older, I've been, you know, more and more relying on some of these things, and it's super frustrating when I don't have my glasses on and I try and use my phone and I can't focus on it. So, you know, I've recently discovered in control, you know, the control thing where you can go in. Control center, thank you.
Yeah.
I recently discovered I can actually adjust the fonts right there. Like, you know, I can, you know, so yeah, I'm discovering these things slowly at a time.
Yeah,
like on the weekend I was in Chicago in a hotel room, and I had just lying in bed checking things, and I wanted to look at something and I couldn't, and I just realized, oh yeah, I can turn this thing on, and then I can just very quickly make my fonts larger. So that's like a minor thing, like a lot of like easy thing to do is use dynamic type and use all the sort of stuff that Apple's been giving us, and, you know, Swift UI, obviously, I think it has a lot of accessibility built in.
Definitely.
Right? But yeah, I forgot what my question was. But yeah, sort of like I've seen videos, like I posted one of our videos we posted. I was thinking about this before I joined the call this morning today, that there was a young gentleman who did a video on how he has like the touchpads behind his head.
Was this Chris Hills?
Might have been. Yeah, I think that sounds familiar. Yeah,
he's using Switch Control to like edit movies with his head.
And that was
amazing.
And funny, like super funny, right? So
yes.
But yeah, like that's like those are the kind of things that I think that the average engineer doesn't think about, you know, in their day-to-day job, that there are people using your app who need like all the sort of pieces all to be accessible, mm-hmm. I guess, right? So
yeah.
When I was at Apple, you know, a couple of years ago, it was when they had a big accessibility push. I think it was 2020 or 2021, and it was a center of a lot of talks at WWDC, I think, that year, right? Mm-hmm. So that's another reason why I thought it was kind of important. But and I think that's where I stumbled across your name, actually.
Yeah, I think I gave a talk that year, so that would make sense.
Cool. So are you going to be talking about accessibility at SwiftTO? There's a reason why we're talking to somebody.
Yeah. Yes. I will be talking about accessibility, although unlike, I think, most of my previous talks, usually I've done technical talks and I've done, like you were saying, like, here's how to implement accessibility for voiceover, here's dynamic type, things like that. And this one will be different. This one is looking at more about accessibility at the company scale. Like, what does it mean to build an accessible product? Like, what does that term mean? And then we'll also be looking at the culture of a company and how that can lead to a more accessible product, and like what it takes to have a culture that cares about accessibility. What does it mean to have an accessibility team, and like what are the different formats for that? So yeah, I'm excited because it's a new talk. I'm still writing it, truth be told. Or actually I've written it, but I'm still working on the slides. And but it's felt important to talk about that because I think that in some ways it can be easy to focus on just the APIs, but often if you're in the context of a larger company, there's so much more to making the product accessible.
Yeah, and it's not just the iOS app, it's the Android app, it's the website, it's, mm-hmm. you know, even calling in on the phone kind of thing can be part of that whole thing, right?
So yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing about changing a culture to be more accessible. It's interesting. So mm-hmm. So let's say you are given like an elevator pitch to my company, what would you say about how to become an accessible company?
I talk about in my talk is that accessibility is both a state of a product, a product can be accessible, and it's also a practice that a company has to practice in order to maintain that state. And so, you know, any company can hire contractors, can hire people to come in and make a product accessible one time. But if you as a company actually want to build an accessible product, then you need to have a practice of accessibility. It needs to be part of how the product is developed. And the process to making a product accessible, from what I've seen in my time in industry, it doesn't happen just at the coding phase, right? The product starts long before the code ever starts. It starts with the inception and the product. Maybe you have product people, maybe you're just a group of folks talking about an idea, but either way, it starts there with the idea. Like, what does this idea mean for someone who maybe can't see, for someone who maybe can't hear? What does this idea mean in those cases? How do we think about it? And then it goes through every phase of the product, right? It goes through the design, it goes through the implementation, of course, the code itself, it goes through the QA process. The feedback that then comes in, how do we handle that feedback? How do we think about it? But every part of the company's practice also needs to have accessibility in it. And so that's why it can't just be an afterthought, because you can't have something be all of your, in all parts of your process, and also an afterthought. Those don't go together.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, no, that's a good point. I worked at a Canadian bank for years, and we had actually a visually impaired gentleman with a dog and a whole team of people who dealt with accessibility. I see what you're saying about that, right? Mm-hmm. But how would you help someone become an advocate for in their company to try and drive some of these ideas in their culture?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is it can be really hard, right, to advocate for these things internally. I think one of the most important things that I've learned when it comes to like advocating for accessibility is that it's consistency. It's not just about, it is about speaking up. It's very much about speaking up. It's about elevating the voices of people with disabilities, whether they're inside your company or outside, but helping those voices be heard. But then it's also about doing it consistently. And I think it can be tempting to, you know, to make a cool prototype that showcases accessibility. It can be tempting to give a talk internally about accessibility. And those are all awesome things to do. And I fully think, you know, people should do them if they're motivated to. But the tricky part is then continuing to do those things and continuing to bring up the topic and not letting it just be a cool moment, but reminding people that this isn't about a moment. This is whole lives. You know, if someone has a disability, it can often be, not always, but often be a lifetime thing. And so accessibility also needs to be considered kind of as this long-term thing, not a moment. And so I think along with kind of doing, you know, pushing for accessibility in a way that feels good to you and feels like a way you can do it, it's then remembering to do it consistently. And I think that's the biggest thing that I've certainly had to learn the hard way, and now I'm trying to embody, is just that level of consistency with like continuing to approach it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I saw an article from Microsoft I think it was a month or so ago, that they kind of they pointed out that accessibility isn't just like, you know, someone who's been injured in an accident or someone who's born mm-hmm. with a disability. It can be me like hurting my leg and not being able to walk or drive my car. Now I have to get a wheelchair while I'm recuperating, mm-hmm. or even me lying in a hotel room without my glasses on, you know, temporary accessibility as well. And it can be like, sometimes it's visible, sometimes it's not visible. Like, you know, can be deafness or mutism, not being able to speak, I guess. Mm-hmm. But you know, it can be any number of things that it make that require some sort of accessibility assistance, right? From a product. Yeah,
exactly. It's so true. Yeah. It can be, you know, a lifetime disability. It can be, like you said, it can be situational, it can be temporary disability, like all of these things. Like, accessibility is just about meeting the person where they are, and like where they are can be right now or can be always. Like, it's just about meeting them there.
Sure. Yeah. And I read somewhere that I think, or saw something, I think that 18% of Americans have some sort of disability of some type, right? So, you know, when we look at the numbers and say, well, does it justify this feature being added? Well, if you can extrapolate and say 18% of your audience might need accessibility, maybe you should mm-hmm. think about it, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's easy to think of disability as, I think, as an other problem, but it's not. Like you said, then it is, disability is everywhere. It is often invisible. And I think it's important for it to be part of the conversation whenever we're making something for people, because people have disabilities.
Right. Cool. All right. Well,
many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I have another part of the show. You saw one of my interviews, and I like to ask these questions to people to sort of, you know, for surprise them, I guess, and surprise me too, in terms of the answers, right? They're not some of them are based on Marcel Proust questions. In fact, the first one is a Marcel Proust question, and some of them are Stephen Colbert questions and a few that I've made up. So, if you're ready and you're seated comfortable, we can start in on those.
Okay, I'm ready.
You ready? Okay, cool. So what is your motto?
Oh my gosh.
What's the reason people come to summer?
Oh, I don't, this is like really hard. Do I have a motto? I feel like my old motto used to be try harder, which sounds awful. Like, I don't know if that's my current motto. But I don't know if I have something better than that. Generally, the idea is actually, someone just said this to me the other day and I loved it. I wanted to steal it. They said to me, Summer, you're someone that gets things done. And I like to think about that as true. Like, if someone comes to me especially if it's for a work situation, for something around accessibility, it's because I'm going to do it. Like, I really am very action oriented, and I like that about myself.
Well, all right, that's acceptable. Who are your heroes in real life?
In real life, that's a really good question. I think in there's some some folks in the acrobatics world that obviously I have a lot of admiration for, and some artists that I follow very, very closely. And I think that, you know, for me, I spend so much of my time being kind of on the computer and in my head that if someone can create art that like pulls me out of my head and like puts me like more in my heart and more in my like feelings, that's something that I really admire. And I think it's really, really important. So I think on the kind of artistic side of my life, I can think of, you know, some artists that I really admire. And, you know, in the technology side, I think, I mean, in truth, a lot of the engineers that I worked with at Apple are people I admire to this day and will continue to admire. You know, people on the accessibility team, some of the longtime engineers that have like worked on Xcode, or some of the Swift team. Like, these are just some of the most brilliant people I've ever met. And it's an honor to have worked with them. And I still, you know, I follow their work today.
Cool. All right. What words or phrases do you overuse the most?
Probably analyze this podcast and find out. Gosh. I think I say, I use the word absurd a lot. That is I think I refer to many things as absurd. I'm trying to take the word crazy out of my vocabulary, and I think I've replaced anything, I'm trying to replace it with absurd. I think that's a better word. And what else? Yeah, I don't know. That's the only one I can think of off the top of my head. Absurd. Okay. I say that a lot.
All right. Well, let's go back to, what is your favorite word?
Favorite word. In Spanish, and this is not in English, but in Spanish, there's, I actually forget if it's dawn or dusk. I think it's dusk, but there's the word madrugada, and I'm saying it terribly because my Spanish accent's not very good. Madrugada. And I think it's the most beautiful word in the world. Like, I just love that word. I think it's just so pretty to listen to. In English, when I was very young, I got obsessed with the word spatula. I don't know why. I just thought it sounded like spatula, like sounded so good. And it sounded it almost sounded onomatopoetic, even though I don't think it's supposed to be. And I really liked it. So that's in English, that one comes from like childhood, like 10 years old. And then yeah, madrugada for Spanish.
Cool. All right. What's the best sandwich?
Oh, the best sandwich. Well, I think we can, as long as we can call bagels sandwiches. I live in New York now, and so my go-to is an everything bagel with lox and chive schmear, and that is my go-to, and I could live on that.
Yeah, I'm gonna allow that one. Cool. Apples or oranges?
Oh, definitely apples. My fridge is full of them.
Yeah, and can you put peanut butter on an apple?
Oh yeah, definitely. Cool. Peanut butter goes on almost everything.
yeah. Have you ever asked anyone for their autograph?
Oh, I think only once. I was at a concert, it was a Joshua Bell concert, and I was very young, maybe like 14. And I was a very big Joshua Bell, he's a violinist, and a very big fan of him. And he came out afterwards, and I think I did ask for an autograph, but I think that's the only time. I had him sign, I think it was the Red Violin soundtrack, if I remember correctly.
Cool. Well, if you ever write a book and I run into you and I have the book in my hand, you're going to sign it.
Oh, I don't know if I ever read a book.
Well, you never know. What's your favorite action movie?
I don't actually watch a lot of action movies.
Well, what's your favorite movie? Let's go with that one.
Okay, we'll do that. I think my comfort movie is Moulin Rouge, no question. I probably have the whole thing memorized. Wow. I think one of the best movies of that I've ever seen is, this is a classic, I think everyone loves this, is 12 Angry Men. That's just an incredible classic that I love so much. I won't necessarily say it's my favorite action movie, but I have just recently watched the two newest Spider-Man movies, the Spider-Verse ones, and they're animated, obviously, but they're still action. And those are, like, the animation there blows my mind. I could watch those all day. So those are definitely, I think, as action as I get.
Yeah, it's funny. I just saw the last one, too. And as an artist, and as digital artist as well, I keep looking. I can't watch the movie and not think, how do they do that scene? You know, like, as I'm watching the textures in the background, I'm, you know, not so much even, like, watching people punch each other. I'm just looking at the skylines and the color effects and stuff like that. But timely-wise, I have to ask you, though. It may be a new question. May only survive for a short while. It's kind of a four-parter.
Oh, okay, wow.
Barbie, Oppenheimer, Barbie before Oppenheimer or Oppenheimer before Barbie?
Oh my goodness. I haven't seen any yet, but my current thoughts on how I'd like to approach this is Oppenheimer before Barbie.
Okay.
And the reasoning would be that I feel like Nolan films tend to make me think a lot. And I'm going to need to clear my mind eventually. So I feel like I'd start the day early with Oppenheimer, have a good think over my bagel. And, you know, then toward the evening, that's when maybe a little tequila and Barbie lighten the mood a bit.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. So I have a side question, though. So, like, I don't know if you know that there's an IMAX 70mm IMAX special edition of Oppenheimer.
I've heard.
It's only playing in 30 cinemas. I don't know if it's playing anywhere in New York. It's playing in two near me.
Okay.
And I had a ticket on Monday, but I had to fly to Chicago, so I had missed it. So I watched it.
Oh.
I saw Oppenheimer last Friday. I found a single seat, and I went and watched it in a really good theater downtown. But I have to go back and watch it on IMAX. But I'm curious, like, if you could, would you go see it in that format? In New York,
yes.
Somewhere.
Yeah. If I could, I would definitely look for that format. I love it. I don't know. I kind of enjoy the specialty film formats. Like there's a Cinerama in Seattle. I think it closed down, but whenever I was in Seattle, I'd go see something there just because it's like such a specialty format.
Yeah, we have a place called TIFF here. Well, we're going to be at TIFF and it's Toronto International Film Festival, Bell Center, Bell. TIFF, Bell is our phone company here, but I got the name completely butchered, but I'm a member of TIFF, and I go see, like, you know, they'll show a movie and I'll run down and see it, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I've seen like Terry Gilliam movies that came out in the 80s on film. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, a friend of mine put on a showing of Clerks on film, you know, which is kind of really cool, like things
that's
you've
awesome.
Only ever seen them on VHS before, right? So
yeah,
that's cool. Well, I'm glad we got the Barbie Oppenheimer thing out of the way.
Very important.
Yeah. What is the most used app on your phone?
Oh, gosh. I think it's... it's so embarrassing. I think it's probably Instagram. And I hate that that's true, but I think it is. I'm going to go check. I'm gonna give a real proper answer. We're going to check screen time. And we're going to really find out. But I'm betting you it's Instagram. Mostly just because that's where all my circus friends are. So there's a lot of video content. So it really pulls me in because I'm watching them do all their cool tricks. Okay, it's pretty much a tie between Instagram and messages, which that makes sense. I do a lot of texting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny when I look at my phone, we use Slack at work. So Slack ends up being my top. I thought you'd like to hear that. What's your idea of perfect happiness?
Oh, wow. Perfect happiness. I you got deep real quick. Okay. Let's see. Perfect happiness. I think for me, it's about being fulfilled in kind of different ways. Happiness to me is almost a misnomer of the state that I'm thinking of. Cause to me, happiness is like, it's a peak. You have peaks and troughs. And, I guess for me, it's perfect happiness would be more of contentment. And that would be being fulfilled in my work, in my personal life. So like work that I find fulfilling, a personal life that, you know, brings joy. And then in kind of all the other spaces, like finding ways to for expression and art, I think is something that brings me great joy. And so I think if I have those kind of facets of my personality met, kind of like the friendships, the work and the art, then that is I feel content in that place.
Cool. All right. This is my original question, but I'm going to go back to the original version of it. It's been modified over the podcast.
Okay.
But so Star Wars or Star Trek?
Oh, that's good. Definitely Star Wars for me.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, yeah. I did grow up on Star Trek, but I think I fell in love with Star Wars a little bit more just because of the time I watched them in my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of people have been fighting for Star Trek in the last, you know, several episodes, right?
Oh.
Yeah. Actually, I had one, Daniela, with Stargate, which I thought was interesting. And I interviewed James Thompson, who had me put Doctor Who on the list, right? But
if I had been there, I would have gone with Doctor Who.
Cool. How far back with Doctor Who do you go? Do you go like the new series or the original series? Or
I haven't seen the new series. I haven't seen the most recent seasons, but I saw the new series up until Jody came on. I saw them probably, I think I saw it three times through, the whole new series. And then the old series, I don't think I've seen everything, but I've probably seen them most episodes at least once.
Cool. All right. What number am I thinking of?
72.
Oh, so close. You actually got them backwards. You're the closest person.
Oh, it's 27?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. That's amazing. That's amazing. last question. Do you have a dream that you can remember?
A dream that I can remember. Oh gosh, I do. This isn't a recurring dream, but it's one I had as a child. And it was, my grandmother did a lot of the work raising me, and she wore this turquoise ring, this huge turquoise ring, and it scared me as a little girl. And in the dream, the turquoise ring was like in the wall, and it had a face on it, and it would like talk to me, and it would like steal my cookies and things. And that dream, to this day, I can still remember it, even though I probably haven't had it since I was 5.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. One of my dreams that I can remember is I was thinking I was about 6 or 7. Mm-hmm. I remember not being able to go back to sleep after that one for sure.
Still sticks with me.
All right. Well, this is the part of the show where I ask you to tell the listeners, you know, how to get in touch with you if they want to and where they can find you. And let's go with Twitter, just in case you want to use that one as one of the options. Because this weekend they changed, right? So I'm still calling it Twitter. I don't care what anybody says.
Yeah.
But so
same.
So Summer, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
So I am still on Twitter, although, you know, see how long that lasts. But it's just my first name, Somer, and that's at Twitter. So just a simple handle there. You can also find me on Mastodon. Same thing, Summer, but it's I have to give my domain is Macaw Social.
I'll have links in the show notes. So.
Oh, great. So yeah, it'll be Summer at Macaw Social. Those are probably the main two for social media. And if you are interested for some reason in my weird circus shenanigans, that would be Instagram, and that is Summer Rope with just one R in the middle.
Oh, cool. All right. Well, my name is Tim Mitra, TimMitra on the Twitter machine, on Mastodon, on Blue Sky, on what else is there?
Threads. There's threads now.
Yeah, I'm on Threads too. Well, there's not much, you know, I'm disappointed in Blue Sky and Threads. There's not much happening over there yet, but I guess it's early.
I'm technically on them, but I wouldn't say I'm going to use them yet. I just kind of am checking it out.
yeah, cool. Well, so until next time, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends. Please leave a comment on the website, and if you can, please write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you. So use the hashtag AskMTJC. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is @MTJC_podcast. Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/MTJC. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.
No, that was super fun. Thank you.
Yeah. So what do you do for in Brooklyn? How is Brooklyn because of work or?
Brooklyn? No, it was really just I'd always wanted to live in New York. Is really all it is. And yeah. I think a lot of people kind of had their like I don't know kind of like a come to Jesus moment during the pandemic. Where for me it was just like I want. It was tough because I was like, if I stay at Apple, which was what I was kind of intending to do, I was like, I'll never get to live in New York, most likely. And okay. Like, I was pretty bummed about that thought. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to take the chance. I'm going to do it. So I moved out here, got a job at Slack, which is based in San Francisco, but they have, you know, fully remote roles. And just did it. And mostly I think New York drew me in because of the arts and the performance here. There's a ton of circus community. And so, yeah, that's kind of what happened.
Yeah, I think Manhattan's a real magnet for me, too, especially because I studied fine arts, so I'm more, you know, the MoMA and Guggenheim and things like that, right? They're kind of attractions for me. Like, whenever I'm in a city, I'll go and visit the art gallery if I have, like, an hour, even just an hour, right? So
yeah.
But that's cool. So did you move out during, while everything was still closed down? Like, did you make that decision to move to Brooklyn or change jobs during the pandemic? Or
Yeah, it all happened during, I would say, like, late phase pandemic. Like, things were starting to kind of open up when I made the decision. But certainly not, you know, it was still definitely, like, you know, pretty consistent masking. And, you know, I think we were only up to 3 vaccines or something then. But yeah, it happened during the pandemic. I arrived in New York, actually drove across the country over Christmas, over the holidays. And I got to New York in, like, January 3rd, I think, of 2021.
Did you drive straight through, or you take your time and check things out as you came?
Took my time, yeah. I did I did the southern border route because I didn't want to have to deal with snow in an RV. I rented an RV. Did the southern border, and I think I did 11 days. Yeah.
So is that like cross Texas to Georgia and then up the coast? Kind of?
Yeah, exactly. Like, all the way to the Florida, all the way to Florida. I think Jacksonville is where you make the turn, and then you head north.
And have you done these treks across the U.S. in the past, or just
that was the biggest? I'd never done a full U.S. crossing, and that was always one of my dreams. So I kind of got 2 dreams with, like, New York, U.S. crossing, in an RV. Checked off 2 boxes there. I'd never done that road trip that big before. I'd done, like, the West Coast, and I'd done the East Coast for the most part, but I hadn't done the big thing.
I didn't ask you, like, where were you originally from? Like, where were you?
Oh, I was born in Portland, Oregon, lived there for 18 years, and then Bay Area after that.
I see. So you're a West Coast person, left
Very
Coast person.
Very West Coast. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, very West Coast person, but I needed my stint in New York. I don't know if New York is forever for me, but it's definitely, like, a wonderful place to have, you know, a few years of my life.
Yeah, I think, you know, of the American cities, for me, New York's probably the biggest and most challenging, I guess, but Boston is attractive. I went to a lot of conferences in Boston in my early publishing career. And then, obviously, the Bay Area, right? I've never been to LA, so no opinion about that. And I've been to Seattle, because when I started iOS, I mean, I kind of had to learn iOS real quick, because it was like a job land on my desk, and I knew nothing about iOS other than there was an SDK, right?
Yeah.
And the iPad was coming, and I had to be on the iPad early, so I jumped on a plane and flew to Seattle. So that's why I kind of wandered around Seattle a little bit, so I've lived in Vancouver too, so I thought it's kind of, I'm used to that kind of life, but I think San Francisco is a draw, but of course it's super expensive, right? New York's not too cheap either, but I guess, is that why Brooklyn as opposed to Manhattan, kind of thing, is that a more economical choice?
Definitely, it's a little more economical, mostly like with the HOAs. Like, the HOAs in Manhattan are they're just a whole nother rent. It's pretty steep. And Brooklyn was just a little more affordable. I could get a little more space. It's a bit quieter. You know, I'm in Brooklyn Heights, and I live right on the park. And yeah, it's pretty quiet compared to, you know, the hustle bustle of, being in Manhattan. So those were all part of the decision.
But if you want to go, like, spend a Saturday downtown Manhattan, you can just jump on a train,
my aerial studio actually is right in Midtown, and I think it's door-to-door 35 minutes, and that includes all the walking and all that, too. And so, yeah, it's pretty quick, Midtown, and Midtown in 30 minutes. I can get to, like, Soho in, like, maybe 20.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. Like I said, my only experience is I think maybe traveling. I don't think I've been to, like, LaGuardia, and I've been to JFK, but I don't think, like, other than that, I've only ever been in Manhattan, like Penn Station kind of thing, and from there walking around, right? So
yeah,
cool. Yeah, I got to go to, like, an Apple workshop in 2017, so that was fun.
Nice.
Was it 2017? Somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And I had like an hour to do MoMA, so I went to the top floor and ran down.
Oh my gosh. I still haven't done MoMA. I need to catch up on it. I've been doing a lot of Broadway shows, but I haven't done a lot of museums yet.
MoMA is obviously, like, somewhere I would like to have spent more time, but yeah, I was just sort of, I had been there before, so I knew what was generally there, but Yeah. I just sort of had to do an update kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, museums are fun because they change. Like, you know, even if you go like within 6 months, they've put new things in. I was disappointed for the longest time because the San Francisco Modern Museum was closed for like, I can't tell you how many years, right? Mm-hmm. So I think I went to an Apple thing and the company I was with were doing a workshop at Apple. And so I got to do... I got to see the reopened San Francisco Gallery. Oh, no, it was a conference. Yeah, San Francisco Gallery was really cool. So
yeah, I actually went to the SF MoMA. It was after moving to New York, but I was back in San Francisco and I was spending time with a friend there. And we went to, there was a specific a musical installation at the SF MoMA from this Icelandic artist. And so we went to see that and hear it. And it was amazing.
Yeah. Actually, it's around the corner from the new Apple store, I think, at Union Square, right? Yeah.
Not too far.
It's cool. And I went to it's my third or fourth time being in Chicago, so I went to the Art Institute there and just caught up on the American art this time, actually.
Nice.
So I finally got to see the Hopper and American Gothic and you know, in the flesh, as it were. So
that's so cool. Yeah, it's always fun when you see something like, you know.
Well, yes, but I mean, you know, we studied these things and I've, you know, through high school and university, it was always a slide on the wall and you never have any idea of scale or like the Miro paintings are like this big, you know, and then the Picasso ones are like, you know, huge, right? So,
yeah. Yeah, I just saw the Scream for the first time in Norway and it was the same thing where I was like, oh, that's surprisingly small.
Yeah, no, I've been to the Louvre, I've seen some stuff in Europe, but I've not seen that one. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, cool. Well, great to meet you, and I look forward to seeing you in a week or so, I guess, right?
We're almost there. I gotta finish those slides.
Yeah. Time to get on it. So we'll look forward to seeing you at the conference, and looking forward to your talk.
Yeah, thanks. Looking forward to seeing you too. Take care. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Nice to meet you.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.